491.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded and produced for WVUD and our podcast listeners by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. The opinions represented in this program by hosts or guests do not necessarily reflect those of WVUD, the University of Delaware, or my own political campaign committee. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at 12:30 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy.
This land is your land. This land is my land. California to New York Island. Redwood Forest, Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 310, recorded on Sunday, May 31st, 2020. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line, as always, in Idaho, is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
And on the line again in the, I guess we'll say, Washington, D.C. area. Is that correct, Kelly?
That is correct for today, yes.
Okay. We're going to be talking this week about airlines. This is something that I will periodically rant about on the show or offline on or on Twitter or whatever. I don't like airlines particularly, and I have a lot of thoughts about them. As an industry, but they are back in the news again. There have been a ton of bailouts to airlines in the United States and Europe and elsewhere during this coronavirus pandemic, despite the fact that they mostly keep flying, which has really surprised me. I really would have thought that during a viral pandemic, they would have curtailed more commercial flights, but whatever. Enough people, I guess, were not flying or had to be spaced out in some cases that they were the airlines were claiming that at last they needed a bailout and only because of this particular crisis. But as I think we will see, airlines in general private airlines often require being bailed out. You will still see lots of economists insisting that private airlines, as opposed to public airlines, are so efficient and economical, et cetera, et cetera. And yet, remarkably, they're constantly requiring government bailouts anytime there's a crisis, which is almost to suggest that maybe there's an underlying problem between the crises and they just use those crises as a pretext. So we're going to talk first about the current recent round of bailouts in 2020, many of which were probably on the way anyway, or the airlines were going to go bankrupt or whatever before this crisis hit. Then we're going to go backtrack in time, almost 20 years, to the post 9/11 bailouts, which was another round of bailouts that was allegedly tied to a specific crisis, but was very clearly going to be something that was up for discussion, even if that incident hadn't happened. And then we're going to walk back even further to talk about airline deregulation passed in 1978. So let me go to Kelly first to talk about the COVID-19 airline bailouts. Although, again, as I said, I would suggest very strongly to our listeners that many of these airlines were in trouble before this happened. Kelly?
Thanks, Bill. And I just want to echo your point about airlines knowing that they are, quote, too big to fail. Tim Wu, the author of The Curse of Bigness, writes that the major airlines know that, unlike local restaurants, they will never be allowed collectively to fail completely. In practice, the public has subsidized the industry by providing de facto insurance against hard times in the form of bailouts or merger approvals. And now here we go again. So it is certainly true that way fewer people are flying than were flying at this time last year, of course, as a result of the global pandemic. And that sort of has accelerated the rate at which airlines are in a vulnerable position. But airlines have also spent a whole lot of money in the past 5 years on stock buybacks and sending dividends to shareholders, which of course makes them even more vulnerable. Instead of sort of preparing for a rainy day, they continue to essentially pay themselves. And top executives, as a result of the higher stock prices, which were as a result of the stock buybacks, have seen huge increases, while airline workers have seen very little benefit. of the airline industry, which had been doing relatively well before this happened. And so it's really a matter of management and of knowing that they were not going to be allowed to fail. So they continued to line their own pockets, knowing that the American taxpayer would cover them in the case of a rainy day. I think to sort of drive that home, drive that point home most clearly, it's worth pointing out that in between 2014 and 2019, the four biggest airlines, United, American, Delta, and Southwest, paid a total of $39 billion for stock buybacks and $5 billion for dividends. So they spent a combined almost $45 billion on Wall Street, which is 90% of the proposed $50 billion that they're getting in this bailout. So I think it just goes to show you the confidence that this industry had that they would not be allowed to fail, whether it be a global pandemic or a recession or any other sort of downturn in their business. So what airlines got from the U.S. taxpayer is two things. They got $25 billion in payroll support, which is designed to pay their employees. They had to keep 90% of their employees through September, including benefits. And of that $25 billion, 70% was a grant, no return to the American taxpayer, and 30% was a low-interest loan. There's another $25 billion that the Treasury has at their disposal to disperse in loans to the airline industry to cover things besides their payroll. And to your point about planes flying, and they must be like very, very empty, for some reason, this program also stipulated that airlines continue to fly to pretty much all of the cities and all of the routes they typically fly. And these have become known as ghost flights. So in order to get this money, they have to be flying all these planes, which just seems like bad for public health, bad for the environment. I honestly don't see the upswing on that. But one of the reasons we still see so many planes in the sky. It's really unclear in the U.S. that this is even going to help the airline industry. The airline industry has had such a debt problem to begin with, and now they have even more debt in terms of these loans from the U.S. government. The flight attendant union actually said, like, this is a very short-term fix and is going to force more bankruptcies down the line, or it could just force more bailout down the line, I suppose. There's discussion about what would have been a better option. Would it be Chapter 11 bankruptcy, which would have forced these airlines to actually restructure and could have still kept people employed and getting paid? Or could the U.S. have levied sort of more regulations and asks out of these bailout? And I think that's largely what we see in Europe. There are also huge bailouts of airlines in Europe, but the European government seemed to sort of bargain for a little bit more. In Germany, Lufthansa also got a bailout, but the German people received a 20% stake in the company and veto power in the case of a hostile bid. So what Germany is essentially trying to do here is to protect Lufthansa from a takeover. Germany plans to sell back the shares and hopefully turn a profit for the German people once the airline is on more solid footing. Of course, I think the effect on the airline industry will drag on for quite some time, so we'll see how that all shakes out. Alitalia, which is an airline in Italy, has received perhaps the most dramatic assistance as Italy actually plans to renationalize the airline. This airline hasn't made any profit since 2002, which is astonishing. It actually declared bankruptcy in 2007 and has been under state control since then while they were looking for a buyer. Of course, nobody's trying to buy airlines these days, so the state agreed to renationalize it. And they're vowing that it is not a bailout, but that they are actually going to make over and relaunch this airline. This Alitalia has been plagued with inefficiencies, hence why they haven't turned a profit since 2002. So it's really unclear exactly how the state intends to resolve that and turn this airline around. And finally, I'll mention Air France. France sort of flirted with nationalization of the airline in a few press conferences, but they landed on loans and state-guaranteed funds. But they have required some reduction of emissions. Activists are saying that there's not enough accountability over this reduction. It doesn't go far enough. There's not enough transparency. But at least in words, they did make an effort to sort of guarantee some greenness in the airline industry in return for these funds. A complicating factor in each of these situations is that the EU has restrictions on nationalization of companies. It doesn't want nationalization to sort of mess up with the competitiveness in the market and introduce an unfair advantage. So all of these have to be approved by the EU, which is just another level to their governance. In closing, I would say that in the middle of a global pandemic, just like hurried legislation is often really inefficient. It tends to miss the mark. Lawyers and lobbyists tend to create and then use loopholes in this sort of regulation and governance, which is really a shame. But this is a really unique opportunity for governments to affect change on the airline industry, and hopefully to get something back for the taxpayer, which is continuously bailing out these industries. So one thing that they could get back is a decreased carbon footprint. The airline industry has become the fastest growing source of carbon emissions, and there could be an opportunity within these bailouts to start to change that and address that. I would say having empty flights fly would be the opposite of addressing that issue.
And the EU did the same thing too. Like the EU explicitly said, like, if you don't fly these flights, then you will lose your, you know, designated like routes that you've gotten approved by the regulatory authorities to fly between, mm-hmm. you know, this airport and that airport and so forth.
So that is something I don't understand the benefit of. But I think in summary, airlines across the world are being bailed out right now. In the U.S., it appears, and really around the world, it appears that taxpayers are getting very little for these bailouts. As we'll talk about in the historical examples, this happens time and time again. Countries are not going to allow their airlines to fail. Of course, they are important tools for both the economy and culture, and it is important for there to be operating airlines, but it seems like there should be a better model given that the taxpayers are bailing these industries out time and time again. And meanwhile, these industries aren't being especially nice to taxpayers. I mean, I think anyone who's flown in the past couple of years can speak to the fees that tend to get tacked on, the services that seem to get smaller and smaller, the seats that seem to get smaller and smaller. Meanwhile, stock shareholders, the CEOs were making more and more money and not saving anything for a rainy day, but instead counting on the American people to bail them out.
A couple of things that I wanted to say based off of what you just said, and as a reminder for folks, every week, if you go to arsenalfordemocracy.com, we put up a PDF with each episode that has the list of all the links that go with all the notes that we're going through on each episode. The first thing I wanted to say, you know, again, we will be talking more in depth about the historical examples, and mostly focusing on the United States rather than Europe, just because that's the one that we're obviously a little bit more familiar with, and that's more of the focus of the show. The trend in places like Europe or Australia or wherever in the 80s, 90s, and the first decade of the 2000s was less about deregulating a private airline industry and more about in the example just that Kelly just mentioned about Alitalia, privatizing nationalized airlines. Like these were previously publicly owned airlines, and there were a lot of efforts to privatize and sell off those airlines, allegedly because this was going to bring all kinds of benefits. Really, obviously, it's an excuse to like get a bunch of people, get their fingers in the cookie jar, right? Like they're going to get all these shareholder dividend payouts and stock buybacks and all those goodies. It's the same exact principle, more or less, as the, you know, Russian state assets being sold off after the Soviet Union broke up, except in this case, you know, you're generally selling the airlines to a wider number of people than was the case there. But that was kind of the big push. By contrast, the push in the United States was there was an already private industry, and it was about deregulating it and all the alleged benefits that were going to come from that, which we'll talk about and why that didn't pan out. So that was one thing I was going to say, is that a lot of these airlines were privatized and denationalized relatively recently. In some cases, you know, 10 or so years ago, in some cases, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. The other thing is that, Kelly raised the question about Chapter 11 bankruptcy, which is obviously going to come up a lot in the, part that Rachel's talking about and the part that I'm talking about, because so many private airlines do file for these bankruptcy protections in the United States. Huge obvious downside to that is that these restructuring bankruptcies have often been used, as we'll talk about, against workers. So, you know, Kelly was saying, yeah, maybe this gives an opportunity to keep the workers employed, but the flip side is it, you know, can be used to break union contracts and so forth, and do layoffs and things like that. The other thing is that, you know, you would hope that, oh, bankruptcy will allow us to get out from under our creditors with these, you know, ridiculous debt loads and things like that, even if they're self-inflicted. And of course, in reality, what we often see is that when these entities go into receivership, they often work out some deal with the creditors. And, you know, somebody, maybe it's not the people who had originally loaned money to the airlines, but someone will buy up the distressed debt and try to get some amount of money paid back on those later. And that's obviously not great either. So there's not necessarily a lot of good options other than, obviously, I think the option that Rachel and I are going to be evangelizing here is pretty obviously state acquisition of airlines. But anyway, I will go to you now, Rachel. There was another turning point. Less than 20 years ago, in 2001, a number of already very distressed airlines claiming that 9/11 and the shutdown of all air travel for a while shortly after that, or well, immediately after that, but then for some duration, that was the thing that finally pushed them over the edge, and that they would have been fine and not needed government assistance or needed bankruptcy otherwise. A number of those airlines did end up going bankrupt, but even those that did not, many of them received bailouts. And again, there was a turning point there where we could have argued that these airlines were in bad shape to begin with, and that this was not some sort of force majeure incident that, you know, an act of God or whatever, you know, or that, you know, this terrorist attack alone and the government closures of the air industry, that was the real problem here. We could have accepted and admitted that the airlines were not doing well in private hands and taken a more active stance, but instead we had this bailout. So, Rachel, if you could talk to us about what happened in that bailout and some of the criticisms that were levied then, which, you know, as we were approaching this current situation before the pandemic hit, I thought, as you know, the flight attendants union and others had expressed, that the airline industry was in pretty bad shape and was probably headed for another round of bankruptcies or whatever, and obviously should be nationalized. But instead, we got another one of these, as Kelly said, very hurried bailout packages that just looks at the crisis at hand and throws something together without a whole lot of oversight or accountability or substantive change in the industry.
Yeah. So a week after 9/11, Congress just took 2 days to introduce, pass, and get approval for a $15 billion bailout. And $5 billion of that was earmarked for direct payments to stabilize air transport. The one senator who voted against it, Peter Fitzgerald from Illinois, he called it a massive boondoggle, and he said Congress just got out the ladle and shoveled it all over the place. money kind of went where you wouldn't really expect it to go during a bailout that was supposed to be for the transportation system. So, for example, this is from a CBS News article from 2002, I believe, or shortly after, or late 2001. So $20 million was shoveled to three actually bankrupt airlines, Vanguard, Midway, and Reliant. Nearly $165 million went to package delivery companies. Another $5 million went to helicopter companies that, among other things, ferried workers to oil rigs and ran tours to the Grand Canyon. And even three companies that arranged travel from the U.S. to Cuba got money. So it just, it didn't really, there wasn't a lot of oversight over where the money actually went. So like vacation tour operators got bailed out, got somebody who owned a company named Bill LaMachia got $3.5 million. And he just said he was taking advantage of an opportunity. So there wasn't a lot of oversight. It seemed like very hastily decided, and there just some bad decisions got made during that time. So there in 2003, there was an Indiana Law Review article by Margaret M. Blair, kind of looking back at the bailouts and kind of analyzing it and to see if it actually achieved what it was meant to achieve. So the article pointed out that we kind of consider just the infrastructure of the airline industry as a natural monopoly. Those hubs and we kind of use the hub and spoke system. So there's main hubs that drive regional airline traffic. And those airports are a natural monopoly. They're there. You maintain them. They don't really move, but they're kind of set up to most efficiently move goods and people throughout the country. So with that natural monopoly, we're kind of, because it's private, we kind of are put in the position of choosing winners and losers. And so that's something that this article suggested that the Air Transportation Stabilization Board, under the Air Transportation Safety and System Stabilization Act, actually had the power to choose the winners and losers that got the subsidies, and they couldn't really be a neutral actor in picking who got the subsidies and how much. In the conclusion, Margaret Blair stated, "The problem, however, is that the airline transportation system is made up of individual airlines. So any decision to subsidize or shore up the industry as a whole must either grapple with the question of how to subsidize the industry in a way that is neutral as to which airlines get the benefit of the subsidy, or must pick, quote, winners and losers by subsidizing some more than others. The ATSSSA proposed to do some of both. The cash grants and insurance subsidies probably operated in a neutral way because they were available to all airlines on the same terms and on a more or less pro rata basis, according to the volume of business each airline did prior to September 11th. Yet the loan guarantee part of the act required case-by-case negotiations over terms, which inevitably forced the ATSB into the role of deciding which airlines were worth saving and on what terms. For this reason, the loan guarantee part of the act was most controversial from the beginning, and the Bush administration, which was called upon Congress to administer the ATSSSA, actively resisted playing the role of banker." She also pointed out, so far, the loan guarantees actually approved by the ATSB suggest that the policy of the board is to demand terms that are nearly as stringent as, and maybe more stringent than, the airline would face in the private financial markets. The guarantee granted to America West required a restructuring of claims against the company comparable to what might have been required in a Chapter 11 restructuring. The offer of a loan guarantee for U.S. Airways did not keep this airline out of bankruptcy, and it remained unclear as of early November whether the airline would be able to reemerge from bankruptcy, even with a federal loan guarantee. Meanwhile, United Airlines was unable to muster a sufficient amount of concessions from its unions and creditors to satisfy the ATSB and was compelled to file for bankruptcy after the ATSB denied its loan guarantee request. So far, the loan guarantees that have actually been approved by the ATSB appear to have been little more than substitutes for Chapter 11. Thus, in practice, they have mostly provided a symbolic subsidy, not a real one. Yet the cash payments doled out last fall were real, and the promise made last fall of further subsidies, though perhaps only symbolic, probably had real effects. Given the negative connotations and sense of failure associated with reorganization through the bankruptcy courts, it was probably useful symbolically last fall to offer airlines an alternative approach to restructuring that does not carry the stigma of bankruptcy. The ATSSSA has done that. It remains to be seen whether the ATSB can respond to the applications it has received and still manage to get out of the way and let the airlines reorganize themselves to serve a more cautious, price-conscious market in a way that allows them to make a profit and stay in business. And something, a factoid that was included on just the airline Wikipedia article under the bailout section stated that between 2000 and 2005, U.S. airlines lost $30 billion with wage cuts of over $15 billion, and 100,000 employees got laid off. In the article, Margaret Blair did quote Robert Reich, and he said that although political pressure to bail out large corporations in the past has often come from labor organizations that wanted to save jobs, Robert Reich has argued that the role played by government bailouts of corporations in the past has not ultimately been to preserve jobs or to avoid needed restructuring. In the bailouts that he studied, all of the corporations ultimately shrank substantially and redeployed many assets. The bailouts, in fact, accomplished many of the same things that might have been accomplished more quickly in a bankruptcy proceeding or private workout. Government involvement, he argued, does little more than, quote, slow the pace of shrinkage. So I think that's something that we did see over the course of the past two decades. There really wasn't any significant improvement in the airline industry. They still made the same bad choices. They still run the same inefficient system. So the bailouts post 9/11 didn't really fix any underlying problems. They just kind of slapped a Band-Aid on the wound and called it a day, basically.
All right, so let's talk a little bit more about the history of the airline industry in the United States. Obviously, over the past several weeks, we've been talking a lot about the history of railroads in the United States, particularly in their early period, and there's certainly a lot of parallels between the rail industry and the airline industry. Foremost among them, the fact that the basis of how the rail industry was governed and regulated in the United States had a profound impact on how the airline industry was handled in the United States. And it was always in the back of the minds of lawmakers whenever they were making decisions, passing legislation, creating agencies, setting regulations, whatever, on the airline industry. Let's pick up a little bit on this natural monopoly issue that Rachel had mentioned in passing just a few minutes ago, because it does speak to, again, a similar problem that we've been talking about over the last several weeks with regard to both the rail industry and the technology industry. If you have an industry that requires a great deal of capital investments, and you have to build out various infrastructure, there is going to be a problem of either you have too much stuff invested in a given area relative to the level of demand, in which case the prices fall below what it costs to operate the thing, and then one of them goes bankrupt. We certainly see that happening. Or we see natural monopolies arise within a given region. As Rachel said, hub and spoke certainly lends itself to that. I think that probably a lot of lawmakers in the United States, for whatever reason, couldn't visualize the intensive upfront infrastructural investment that is baked into the airline industry in the way that they can with a railroad or a telecommunications line. Like, obviously, you can see them putting down the tracks and you can see them laying, you know, the fiber optic cables and broadband cables and so forth. I think a lot of lawmakers maybe were under the impression that, well, an airplane can fly anywhere, so you can basically create a route anywhere from point A to point B and so forth, and that will be, you know, that's our ideal situation, and this will allow the flexibility of, you know, airlines to dip in and out. That is, of course, not really how the airline industry works. First of all, there's regulations even today to some extent on, you know, where you fly, what routes you can do. It's less than it used to be, but there's still some provisions, and that's certainly very true in Europe. But also, as Rachel said, like, the airline company is going to put a lot of investment in their specific hub airports because they can't really afford to, because sometimes people will say, well, I don't understand, why do they do the hub and spoke system? And in fact, when deregulation happened, for some reason, a lot of the lawmakers thought that the hub and spoke system would go away. Instead, it became much stronger. We now have these sort of budget airlines that do a lot more direct flights because there's obviously a market for that. Customers don't like having to take connecting flights. But for the most part, the hub and spoke system obviously makes some amount of sense, especially for a very large airline, right? You don't want to build support infrastructure for your airline at every single airport across the country. You know, you have to have, if you have multiple airlines in an airport, you have to have your own facilities for storing your planes, and you have to have your space for your employees, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That stuff tends to add up. It's obviously much easier if you have concentrated your operations in certain specific airports and you fly to and from out of that, right? So you say, I will fly the plane from point A to point B and then back to point A, and it goes, you know, and that's where we're going to store it for the night or whatever. That is much easier than just infinitely flying around airlines between every possible combination of airports, and that is why that system tends to emerge. It may be harder to see that visually than laying down a rail line, but the principle still applies. And the result we see, of course, is these natural monopolies arise in these specific regions. And again, the question then becomes, why would you have multiple airlines if that's the problem, that they can't afford to each airline have full facilities at every single airport? Why would you have multiple commercial airlines, privately owned airlines, I should say, at all? Why would you not have it nationally owned? And so for that, we need to go back to the beginning of the airline industry in the United States. Whereas most countries in the post, because a lot of this stuff basically emerges after the air power is really demonstrated in World War I. So we're talking about the interwar era here, the 1920s, the 1930s, and then even, you know, obviously there's changes in the 1940s as well, with World War II underway. But the 1920s, you have, and there had been like attempts at airlines a little bit here and there before then, but this is when it really takes off, right? No pun intended. You have a bunch of these countries say right off the bat, we're going to just have a nationally owned airline, right? Maybe we'll have two nationally owned airlines, but they're both going to be owned by the government. We're going to have to invest a lot in getting the airline industry up and running and regulated a lot. So we might as well just have direct ownership of it. In countries like Australia in the post-World War II period, those airlines have been subsequently, as I alluded to earlier, been privatized, but originally those were nationalized entities pretty quickly as well, whether or not they started nationally or had a brief phase in private ownership. The similar challenge that we have with the rail industry, in some parts of the United States, it was certainly true in a place like Australia, right? You have huge distances to cover. It's nationally imperative for the public interest that you have air service provided, but it is very expensive to provide that, and not necessarily, especially at the beginning of the industry, you don't necessarily have the level of ridership necessary to sustain that, so it's not really privately viable. But you can say, okay, in the public interest, like with a publicly owned subway or something, we're going to run this at a loss because it's in the public interest to have this service. A lot of European countries in the interwar era had taken similar approaches. They also were government owned and invested. The United States, being the United States, did not take this approach, unsurprisingly, I think, to everyone. The U.S. Postal Service had done some early experimentation, and then a lot of the functions were transferred to the Commerce Department. But at the beginning of this process, the United States put a huge amount of investment from the government into an industry that was, of course, in private hands almost exclusively. So one of the big things that had to happen was, first, you had to have industry standardization. Now, we talked a lot about this with regard to railroads in the previous episodes, talking about, you know, standardization of gauges and things like that, as well as safety equipment. We also talked about how Standard Oil in the oil industry was able to get a great deal of its edge and consolidation by setting official industry standards. So again, there's obviously some role for some centralizing force to provide standardization for safety. And that force was provided by the U.S. government through the U.S. Postal Service and then the Commerce Department early on. It would have been obviously a chaotic disaster if every private airline was attempting to set its own standardization and safety regulations in the way that the railroads had been allowed to do, pretty disastrously, I would argue, in the mid-19th century. The second thing that happened was infrastructural investment. Again, this gets back to this issue of natural monopolies, state monopolies, etc., and the obvious fact that the private industry is never going to be able to bring up the level of capital required to do this. Specifically, the United States government built a network of lighted airfields and radio beacons all across the entire country. Obviously, no airline was going to make that level of investment all over the United States, both in terms of standardization and making sure that there is this equipment in place and places to land at preset distances all over the entire United States. That's a huge, huge investment that the U.S. government made, and yet we did not nationalize the air industry as we obviously should have. This is something that requires massive amounts of subsidies behind the scenes from the public entity in order to support this industry, both getting off the ground and staying in the air the entire time. And the private industry could never do that. So even in conditions where you're saying, oh, this airline looks like it's making a profit, just understand that, as with many of these things, there is a hidden public investment in the background happening the whole time. Much in the same way that you could look at something like the NTSB and say, well, it's a good thing that we have a National Transportation Safety Board to assess accidents and impose safety regulations and things like that and learn best practices from incidents, as opposed to doing it like the meat processing industry or whatever and just have the airlines completely self-regulate themselves, which is not to say that they're not self-regulating themselves, because the airlines have, in many cases, as we will discuss, saved a lot of operating costs and their ongoing costs by cutting their money going towards safety investments. So to that extent, they are self-policing, and that leads to various crashes. But, you know, overall, we have a larger hand from the government than we have in certain industries. So that was the situation in the interwar period. Then you have the Civil Aeronautics Board from 1938 to 1985. They regulated which routes across state lines, because you have to do interstate commerce. You can't just regulate it within a state. Or out of the country, international flights. They regulated which routes could be used by which airlines. They also regulated minimum and maximum prices to be charged on each route. That is what we call the period of airline regulation in this country. And when we're talking about deregulation, we're talking about rolling that back. This was a period where they said, look, we've allowed these sort of de facto natural monopolies to exist in these various things, but they have to charge certain minimum prices for their tickets, because that's what it costs to operate successfully. If we allow a competition war, like we saw with the railroads in our recent episodes in the 1870s period, if we allow a competition war in the ticket prices, this is going to be a race to the bottom where all of these airlines bankrupt themselves by charging less than it actually costs to operate the flights. This is what deregulation rolled back. And you can obviously start to see what we're about to talk about, which is the obvious negative consequences of that. Second thing, maximum prices. That is obviously the kind of, you know, new dealer regulation that you might expect, where it's less about maintaining a certain price floor to make sure that the airline is viable, and it's more about making sure that you don't charge excessively. But again, what we are often talking about with price deregulation is this notion that onerous regulations have artificially propped up the prices, and they would be so much lower under a free market, and that would be good for the consumers. Again, not really taking into account the obvious wave of bankruptcies that was going to follow a race to the bottom situation in prices. So we arrive at Airline Deregulation Act of 1978 under Democratic congressional control and the Carter administration. This followed several years of bipartisan efforts, starting under the Ford administration, of trying to figure out what they were going to do to essentially roll back these regulations in prices and routes and allow a flourishing of bounteous airlines that were going to spring into place. And this goes back to some of the stuff that we were talking about last week with regard to the tech industry and sort of competing liberal approaches to managing monopoly situations. So we have the New Dealer approach that's going on the way out of this, which is to say that the answer to the problems created by these natural monopolies and so forth is to have an extensive bureaucratic regulatory framework, which I'm not necessarily opposed to. But again, I don't think it goes as far, and I'm thinking Rachel's probably on the same page here, doesn't go as far as actual state ownership or just public control, worker control of these huge industrial corporations. The neoliberal approach to this problem, I know that that's, people get, for whatever reason, are getting real touchy about talking about neoliberalism these days, but obviously this is a peak example of neoliberalism emerging in the 70s, is that all of the problems will be solved by just having more market competition. Now, they differ from some of the progressive movement stuff that we talked about in the past couple of weeks, emerging in the late 19th century, where you need regulation and competition. Their answer is no, you basically throw out the regulation and you just have a million little airline companies flourish, and they will somehow create this competitive free market environment that will be good for the people. Now, I mean, I'm saying that in terms of that's what they're on its face saying is the justification for this. Again, I think we all understand that the justification is you're going to create a whole bunch of private wealth by having a bunch of these corporations, and it's good to deregulate for that reason in its own right. And that is certainly not the position of this show. But that was the official justification and the implicit justification for pursuing this deregulation effort. As long as we deregulate this industry and remove these onerous price regulations and let the free market flourish, then everything will be fine. Everything will find its natural equilibrium, and everything will be better. Now, Justice Stephen Breyer of the U.S. Supreme Court was a congressional staffer who was active in the efforts to deregulate the airline industry in the 1970s, and he wrote a piece in 2011 in Business Week, now owned by Bloomberg. I've put the link as usual in the PDF at arsenalfordemocracy.com. And he wrote a reflection on this deregulation several decades after the fact and, what had been the upsides and downsides, mostly still defending it, I think rather ridiculously. But there were some statistics and some points that I wanted to draw out of this article. So he said, what does the industry's history tell us? Was this effort worthwhile? Certainly, it shows that every major reform brings about new, sometimes unforeseen problems. No one foresaw the industry's spectacular growth, with the number of air passengers increasing from 207 million in 1974 to 721 million last year in 2010. As a result, no one foresaw the extent to which new bottlenecks would develop. A flight-choked Northeast Corridor, overcrowded airports, delays, and terrorist risk consequently making air travel increasingly difficult. Nor did anyone foresee the extent to which the change might unfairly harm workers in the industry. Still, fares have come down. Airline revenue per passenger mile has declined from an inflation-adjusted 33 1/3 cents in 1974 to 13 cents in the first half of 2010. In 1974, the cheapest round-trip New York-Los Angeles flight in inflation-adjusted dollars that regulators would allow was $1,442. Today, one can fly that same route for $268. That is why the number of travelers has gone way up. So we sit in crowded planes, munch potato chips, flare up when the loudspeaker announces yet another flight delay. But how many will now vote to go back to the quote-unquote good old days of paying high regulated prices for better service? Now, that is a particularly wild passage that contains a whole bunch of things that I think obviously should stand out to our listeners. A whole bunch of things are, oh, who could have foreseen any of these problems that would emerge? I don't know, literally anybody with a brain, I think. I mean, first of all, nor did anyone foresee the extent to which change might unfairly harm workers in the industry. Yeah, obviously, if you're going into a price competition war, you're going to find ways to cut costs. And the ways that's going to happen is by cutting safety and by cutting union contracts. That's a big reason, as we said, why a lot of these Chapter 11 bankruptcies happen to restructure is to try to break the union contracts and get better deals, or at least have the possibility of bankruptcy and dissolution looming over the union's head so that they'll be forced to agree to it as a point of leverage that they can't counter. Another thing, oh, who could have foreseen that this air travel would have exploded and had all these traffic congestion problems as these industry far outstripped the infrastructural capacity, and suddenly we have everyone sitting around with all these delays. Yeah, man, who could have seen that coming? No way. And then also this incredible conflation here with, oh, the fares have come down, followed immediately by a sentence about airline revenue per passenger mile declining. And oh, it's remarkable how much lower the prices are these days to fly from New York to Los Angeles compared to what the regulators would allow. Huh, did it ever occur to you that maybe the regulators were setting a limit based on trying to control the actual operational costs of the flight and the maintenance costs and the debt servicing costs and all that, you know, all those good things that are necessary for a good industry to run, and the fact that you are attempting to use price with a regulatory regime, which is not necessarily my favorite way of regulating something, but that is a way of controlling things. Yeah, you have the price in place to control the level of the level of demand, right? If you lower the price absurdly in this competition war and you have the passengers explode well beyond the capacity, that's a problem in its own way. But oh, as long as we're all paying less, that's great news, despite how terrible the quality of service is. And this is obviously something that you can look in survey after survey. You see that discontent is rising rapidly and has been for decades now with the private airline industry, and then somehow you still see economists saying, well, it seems pretty clear that passengers around the world are much happier with private airlines than with nationally owned flag carrier airlines that are in state control. So clearly we need to continue to privatize all of those airlines, despite how incompetent and terrible and bankrupt all of these private airlines are and how they keep on adding more and more ridiculous charges. And that's the other thing. You can say, oh, look at how these prices went down on these tickets. It's weird how all the prices for baggage went up and then you have to pay for your food and that there's no legroom anymore. Huh. I wonder how they're shifting around those costs so that they can make the airline ticket look like it was an extremely low price. Wow, that's pretty remarkable, isn't it? Anyway, most of the stated rationale for adopting the Airline Deregulation Act of 1978 makes very little sense, especially in retrospect. They were at the time making comparisons explicitly to recent rail bankruptcies and the necessary formation of Amtrak. This is, of course, a nonsensical comparison, not because it's wrong, but because they thought that this was the solution that was going to prevent a bunch of these passenger airlines from going bankrupt. Again, pre-deregulation era, you have a bunch of passenger railroads either going bankrupt or having to get rid of their passenger rail service because it literally costs more to operate the passenger rail service than you make in revenue from the passenger rail service. By contrast, at the same time period, you have the airline industries under much heavier regulation and these price floors being able to successfully operate without going bankrupt because they didn't have this same set of problems. And then they're saying, well, in order to prevent the problems from happening, that's going to require us to form a national passenger air corporation like we did with the National Passenger Rail Corporation known as Amtrak. We're going to deregulate the airline industry and turn it over to free market. That is completely bonkers. That's literally the opposite of what you should have taken away from that situation. Next thing, the belief that more competition and new carriers operating in different markets would end hub dominance. That doesn't make any sense and also was proven wrong. As Rachel said, hub and spoke became vastly stronger. Regional market domination by specific carriers grew. And the maybe most shocking thing of all is that in all these discussions like that Stephen Breyer article about, oh, look at how these prices have gone down. Yeah, well, it's interesting if you cherry pick an example like New York to Los Angeles, a major direct flight, and say, oh, look how the prices have gone down. When in fact, you realize that because of some of these de facto regional monopolies, which as Rachel said, are a natural monopoly, that the prices in many places actually went up. So yes, the direct flight prices went down in some cases, especially when the emergence of the direct flight budget airlines, which often, by the way, don't have union protections. That's another key factor in their ability to operate lower costs. But again, that is not necessarily true across the board. The other thing is, as I said, what should have obviously been seen on the horizon with this deregulation effort was not less of a bankruptcy risk, but more of a bankruptcy risk. In the period from 1978 to just before 9/11, the period that Rachel was talking about, 8 of the major carriers not only went bankrupt, but they actually disappeared. 100 minor carriers were liquidated or went bankrupt, and many of those carriers were actually carriers that launched after deregulation, hoping to take advantage of this huge, bounteous new free market, which it seems pretty clear, can't actually sustain that level of service and competition. Many of the legacy carriers from the pre-deregulation era, so these were large airlines that existed before 1978 deregulation and the 1980s implementation of that, they eventually did go bankrupt at some point after the year 2000, although, as Rachel said, they went through restructurings and generally did not disappear, although obviously a bunch of them have subsequently been merged into other larger airlines. And as I said, that was often a pretext for breaking or renegotiating union contracts. And then the final thing that we need to talk about here, obviously, is that Essential Air Service, EAS, is a program that was created for similar reasons as what I talked about why Australia originally had state-owned airlines, which is true for certain parts of the United States as well, particularly Alaska, but also places like Wyoming, is that there are many rural areas of this country where it is literally impossible to operate a for-profit airline service because it costs a whole bunch of money to get the plane there, and there's nowhere near enough regular passengers going between those points to justify even a small flight unless you have extensive government subsidies. This was a program that in their neoliberal wisdom of the 1970s, they thought, oh, this program will only need to be around for about 10 years and then we can phase it out. Well, here we are in 2020 and that program still exists. And there's obviously a political reason for this. As many conservative think tanks in D.C. as you want can put out a white paper saying we should eliminate this program and just let the free market handle it or push the subsidies off onto the state governments and the municipal county governments, which is something that we do with things like Amtrak, right? There's a repeated push to say that you don't get passenger rail service unless your state pitches in. What we see here is that this doesn't happen in places like Wyoming or Alaska or whatever because you have Republican politicians that rely on that air service themselves and have many constituents who rely on it. So they are willing to go against this free market push and they're willing to maintain and continue to renew the EAS Essential Air Service government subsidies to provide these rural flights. But all of this essentially adds up in my book to a giant case for saying that there's no reason to have a private airline industry to begin with. They've clearly proven themselves incapable of operating safely and financially sustainably in many, many times now, as we've seen with these two significant rounds of bailouts that we talked about earlier on this episode. And it seems pretty clear that a lot of the inefficiencies that comes from this allegedly so efficient market competition environment would be dealt with by having a national carrier. Again, many countries around the world have a nationally owned flag carrier that is at least part owned by the government, if not outright or fully owned by the government. All right, Kelly, I will go back to you now. Closing thoughts on all of this.
I think the only thing that I would add is like this is just beginning. With an economic downturn, there's going to be less and less business travel. I don't think people are hopping on flights in the near future. Sure, there's been a bailout and there's been an effort to protect airline workers' jobs through September, but this is not going to be over in September. So I just hope that folks continue to use this time to think about what the right answer will be when, and it will happen, that airlines ask for a bailout again.
Rachel, your thoughts?
We've seen time and time again that the airlines are incapable of actually treating our money in a way that helps the consumer, instead using it to line executives' pockets and line the stockholders' pockets through dividends. So I think at that point, we just need to kind of cut our losses at this point and nationalize them, because we've seen that the private companies just can't handle the responsibility. So we need to take that responsibility away from them and nationalize it. As we've seen time and time again, if you have a natural monopoly, the most efficient way to operate it is in public hands. So I think this is just a continuation of that. I would love to see a nationalization effort for the airline industry in the United States.
And despite what you hear from the economists claiming that, oh, everyone hates their nationally owned airlines and loves their privately owned airlines, which that doesn't really pass the smell test in its own right. If you really got people to be honest about it, the reality again is that it is not clear and it hasn't been for quite some time, that they are capable of operating a sustained industry in this country in private hands. That's really the bottom line, right? Eventually, you have to step in and say this would be better in public ownership because the private industry has proven itself incapable of doing it in private hands. They're supposed to provide a certain function. It's clearly not profitable. There were problems under the regulatory regime, but that doesn't mean that like that's the answer either. So we have to break out of that kind of dichotomy. Again, arsenalfordemocracy.com to get all the links and notes on this. Rachel, thanks for being on this week.
Thanks, Bill.
And Kelly, thank you for being on as well.
Thanks for having me.